Kids are so creative, especially when they're given a lot of space and a lot of loose parts. So in playscape design, there's a concept where you just have a space where you just dump a bunch of stuff. And then kids just go crazy assembling those things for whatever.
Reclaim your rhythm. Rethink the rules. Rewrite your life. This is Wildly Intentional, the show where we question the scripts we've inherited and build a life, family, and legacy on purpose. If you're done living on autopilot, come with a curious mind and a courageous heart. Here, we talk about what it means to question, unlearn, create, and build what truly matters. I'm your host, Mandy, Maverick mom of three, maker, family culture builder, lifelong question asker, and the friend people call when they're ready to rethink, well, everything. I'm here to shake the norms, tell the truth, and light the way forward. Hey there, wild one. Welcome back to Wildly Intentional. If this is your first time here, I'm so glad you found your way to this space. And if you've been listening for a while, thank you. Your presence is the soil that this community is growing from. Today's episode is brought to you by EarthMind. And honestly, it's more than that. Because what you're about to hear is EarthMind. It's a living, breathing case study of what EarthMind offers through the transformation we've been walking here at Eureka Moon Farm. Formerly known as Backyard Abundance, EarthMind is a nonprofit on a mission to offer nature-based experiences that cultivate well-being and connection. Their vision is simple and powerful. Everyday connections with nature that renew how we care for ourselves, our communities, and the earth. And I know this intimately because I now serve as the executive director of EarthMind. And today's guest, Fred Meyer, is the founder of Backyard Abundance and the designer who helped us shape this land from the very beginning. You'll hear us use Backyard Abundance and EarthMind interchangeably throughout this episode. And that's part of this rebranding in motion. Now, if you've been following along, you've already heard the origin story of the farm. That was shared in episode 5, where I talk about the history of the land before we arrived and the hidden stories that we unearthed once we got here. And then in episode 10, my husband Tom and I talk about why we started homesteading and why we scaled it all back. So those episodes really hold the what and the why of Eureka Moon Farm. But today is about the how. What have we done since we arrived? How did we decide what we were going to do? What was the plan? Was there a plan? What changed? And what's the reality 4 years later today? So joining me on today's episode, I have two people that have been at the heart of it. Fred Meyer, who's my colleague, a designer, and my co-dreamer. Fred helped us vision and shape this space when it was still just grass and big ideas. You might remember Fred from episode 3, Bloodlines and Storylines. And also with me in this episode is my husband, Tom. And you've heard from Tom in episode 10, as I mentioned earlier. And also, Tom was in episode 2 with me, where we talk about our family's Wolfpack values. But this time, he's joining me as a builder, a doer, and the co-dreamer behind what actually happened here. So today, we share the real story, complete with kit playscapes, rotating chickens, mulch lessons, and the magic of slowing down. This is what it looks like to dream with the land and to keep listening, even as things are growing differently than expected. So if you're standing on your own piece of land or looking at one or dreaming of one, we're in the middle of your own evolving vision and you're wondering, where do I start? Or how do I keep going? This episode's for you. Let's begin.
All right. Well, we're back on the podcast and I got two good friends and men
in the room that support me with all of my wild and crazy ideas, both in coming up with them and refining them and executing them. So I have got Fred Meyer from Backyard Abundance back with me today. Fred, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Mandy. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, I'm so excited. And we've also got the Tom Weber back on the podcast. Hey, honey.
Hey.
Thanks for coming back.
Anytime.
So I got these two together because, you know, Tom and I obviously bought Eureka Moon Farm. And then we, when we got here, realized, I mean, if we're going to do landscaping and things here, we're probably just going to line everything with hostas because that's what we know. And we didn't want to do that. So that's why we brought our friend, our now I can say friend, and my colleague now, Fred, into the room. And Fred, I'll just give the backstory on how I learned about Backyard Abundance and you. I had a play date with a mom and some kids. And at the time, we just had the chicken coop. And I was like dreaming of a mud kitchen and starting to build one out of pallets. And she had told me that she lived at the like former founder's house and there was a stage in the backyard and all these amazing elements for kids to play in. And I thought, what is she talking about? Like, who is this and what company did this with her? And I need to get them to my place. And it wasn't long after that play date that we moved to the farm and I kept you in the back of my head and then reached out. I think, Tom, we are so glad we did. Like having Fred and Backyard Abundance as a part of this property has made it like really come to life.
Fred, I can't tell you how many times that we had multiple pieces of crumpled paper, dirt on the paper of the plan in different sections. You know, if we were out there trenching in for raspberries or whatever it was at the time, we just had in the gator, just this crumpled piece of paper. We're like, all right, let's go back. What's the spacing again? Just so many fun iterations of it. And yes, without the plan, I think we would have been not necessarily up a creek without a paddle, but it definitely helped.
So
yeah, and if I remember right, you had watched some permaculture videos or educated yourself on large scale permaculture, and that's what drove some of your initial designs when I got there. I saw some of those and yeah, I was impressed with what you'd learned and what you'd done already. You very much struck me as people that don't mess around. You once you have a plan, you start going, start digging.
We just needed help coming up with the plan. I think we were open to it and just trying to absorb as much information as possible. So today, I think what we want to do is talk about your initial impressions of the property, Fred, what you kind of thought about the goals and the plan and the planning process. And then like, what was the plan? Like, what did we end up saying that we were going to do? Like the phases, if you will. And then what is the reality? And that's why I have Tom in the room too, right? Is like, what does the farm actually look like? What did we actually do versus not do? And then just learnings along the way. So that's kind of it for today's episode. So Fred, we've kind of talked about where we thought and just kind of being clueless about the farm. I mean, we are talking a old Iowa farm, traditional 80 acres that the six was sectioned off around the house. And so it's just a house and some outbuildings with a couple of windbreaks surrounded by corn and soybeans. So that's really the property as it stood when we bought it in 2020. And Fred, I think you showed up for the first time in January or March of 2021. Can you just take me back to that day? What do you remember about coming out to our place?
Yeah, I remember you calling me and saying, bought 5 acres, a farm, and you wanted me to come out and take a look at it. And I was a little worried that you had the wrong guy. I was very candid. I said, I've designed farmsteads before, but not an entire 5 acre farmstead. I've designed portions of them, like I designed a vineyard and other things, but not the entire farmstead. I wasn't familiar with horses at all. And that was one of the things that you were talking about having. And so I was worried that I was just going to waste your time. And then I got out there and yeah, it was a lot of grass and just big classic Iowa farm. I grew up in Iowa, so I was familiar with farms. And so the space wasn't surprising, but it was windswept and I won't say it was barren, but it was just big. And those are some of the challenges where just it's full sun and not a lot of limiting factors that I can see. And whenever there are no limitations, that just means a lot more work to try and figure out what it is you want to do there. And so that's a gift. You got all kinds of opportunities, but trying to rein in those opportunities and bring that into an actual design, that was the challenge.
And also, I think what had us really excited, like, just we don't know what this farm needs to become, but we know it needs to do something. And Tom, I guess, what do you think? Like, the listener, if they could put themselves in what the Eureka Moon Farm felt like back then.
Honestly, a blank slate would be the, and I think to Fred's idea too, of just, you know, it's a lot of open grass and, you know, there was trees for some good shade, but we needed a lot more. And I think to his point too, we knew we had chickens at the time, we were going to get more. But I think the cool thing that we kind of went back and forth on was just like, let's do whatever. We know we want a garden. We have to have a garden. We have to have an orchard. But how do we make it look awesome? How do we incorporate it into a lifestyle? How do we work with the property? How do we take what's already here and make it insanely better? And then also bring in kind of our thoughts, ideas, beauty. You know, we talk about area beautification all the time. It was a blank slate. Is the best way I could put it. And we were just open to whatever. And so, like Fred, just show us what you can show us, and then we'll just go from there. And so that was fun.
Yeah, I think probably unrealistically, Fred, I was hoping you would be like, this is the perfect soil for a blueberry farm. You guys should just have this be, tell us what it should be. You know, like, I think that's unrealistically in my head, where I was like, this farm needs to be something. I know it is. And I think now in hindsight, 2025, I know it just like, needed to be infused with love and life. And we fell in love with that concept of earthlings, including plants and animals and living things. And I think we've done it. We've definitely infused it with life. I mean, it's everywhere you look now. So I guess, guys, does it make sense to just kind of go area to area and talk about like the plans for the area and then like the reality and what we learned in that area?
Sure. Yeah. And I can start us off by saying one of the big challenges was there was no house. There was a big hole in the ground where the old house used to be, and you didn't have a house constructed. And so trying to visualize what that would look like was another huge challenge, because Tom, you talked about trying to integrate spaces into your life. Well, usually that life centers around where you live. And because the house wasn't there, it was really difficult to visualize what it might become in the future. And it was also difficult to try to really understand the relationships of how the house would relate to different other areas of the farm. And so we had a blueprint of the house, which, you know, I integrated into the plan, but it still made that a challenge. We couldn't design what I call kitchen gardens or up close gardens, right next to the house, because you weren't quite sure what the house was going to look like. So that type of relationship really had to be put a little bit on the back burner. We had to focus on other things, the larger orchard, the farm garden, right? The kind of the CSA garden. And so we had to focus on those things and try to imagine what the relationship would be after the house was actually built.
I thought Fred saw the house. You never saw the house here?
I don't think I ever saw it. I saw aerials of it, but when I arrived, it was just a big hole in the ground.
That hole was in the ground like that for like 3 or 4 years. It was a lot longer than we expected it to be. I guess I always thought the house was there when you started working with us, because that was always on the original blueprint, but you did do that from the aerial.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so in the dream state, Fred put in a picture of the house that we were going to build, which obviously didn't happen. And I think what always threw people from like showing up here was we had this dream state vision that we would show them, right? With like the house we were going to build, and it didn't have the trailer on it, but they're standing there looking at the trailer like, wait, where am I? What's happening here on the visual? So I guess let's just start with the house area. to Fred's point, that was a hole in the ground at the time the plan was to build. We really didn't do anything there. I think we just added a couple arrowwoods for when, like, on that underneath those two maple trees when you first pull in. And we did clear a couple of maple trees to build said house, which in hindsight, we didn't need to do, but now it's like a perfectly cleared space for someone to build their dream property when they're ready.
Still burning that firewood.
We are still burning that firewood. And we have shelves for a kitchen someday. Yeah. But anything either of you want to talk about with like the space with the house? I mean, we got that filled and it just felt so much better to have ground there again. And now it's just a blank piece that I mow. But it's probably one of the least interesting places, but it's also right across from the trailer where we live. So it's where we play the most.
Yeah. I think the hardest thing was just seeing the hole for what, a year?
I think it was longer than that is what
probably.
I'm
probably. Because we had every intention to build said house and we were like, oh, let's not fill the hole in because that's half the basement already dug. And so but then we ended up finding that we had volunteer tomatoes.
all sorts of random stuff.
Yeah. But I think what's been fun about what we've created and with Fred's help is every little piece, nook and cranny of this place has a purpose, has a name, and has fun and excitement built into it. In many ways. And I think what's cool too is, which we haven't really talked about yet, is the kids' areas, the fun and the ability for them to help us create this has been super enjoyable to watch. But right next to that grassy area is probably one of the kids' favorite spots on the farm, which I don't remember who dubbed it, but Fairy Forest.
Yeah, Fred did. Fred's the one that turned us on to these fun little names. Like, yes. Fairy Forest. Simply put, it's like 20 trees that have been limbed up that were planted to be a windbreak. And they're
huge northern pines.
They're amazing trees, but Fred calls it Fairy Forest, and we took off with it.
Yeah.
We let the turkeys graze it down to nothing. We filled it with mulch. We hung up little gnomies and fairies and things, and just like him even calling it Fairy Forest just helped us immerse ourselves in it. And Fred, I guess, like, where do you come up with this stuff? Like, it's just so clever and fun to just take something. I mean, you come out of the chicken coop and you can essentially walk straight through Fairy Forest. So it's very functional in terms of like it used to block the house from the wind, but it's just kind of a boring piece until you named it and inspired us. So do you want to talk about Fairy Forest at all?
Yeah, it's a beautiful little spot. That's the spot that really inspired you to contact me was the natural playscape. And we had just designed several playscapes for residential areas as part of a kind of a pilot program. And so, yeah, that was right in the front of my mind. And so that was one of the funnest places to design. And, you know, the names, the inspiration, it comes from just talking with you and your kids. And the names just kind of come based upon where the area is located, what you want to do in it, and, you know, what its function is. And that's what really drives every single design, whether it's designing a little backyard patio of containers or designing a 5-acre farmstead, the process is the same. Just understanding what it is you want to do out there. Why do you want to be out there? What's gonna tug you outside rather than tugging you in negative ways and saying, you know, come out here and weed me and water me and mow me. We want our landscapes to come out there and tug us out there in just really positive ways. Come play, come be, come harvest, come just enjoy the space. And so those all go into the goals of what it is you're trying to do out there. And that drives every single design decision. And we're always coming back to the goals. Is this going to meet your goals? And play and homeschooling, education, those are one of your main goals. And I know you talked also about having other families be in that playscape as well. And so it wasn't just a small space. It was big, almost playground size space where several families could come and just enjoy themselves. And so we identified who's going to be in a space, what they're going to be doing, how to make it, you know, then we start designing around that. And it just, between that and just doing thorough analysis of the space, those things, if you do a thorough enough analysis, understand the goals, understand the people, what they're going to be doing there, a lot of times the space just designs itself. And there's just, I reach what I call a duh factor, the design. After the design, after several iterations of a design, you just get to it and say, well, duh, that's how it should be. This is the design. Why did we come up with this, you know, a week ago or 2 weeks ago? And that's when you just get that feeling in your gut and your body that says, yeah, this is it. This is the design. And we try to do 3D renderings as well so that you can see it from a ground level view or an aerial view. So it really tries to convey what it's going to feel like when you're actually in the landscape, even when it's just a blank canvas like what you had.
Fred, you're making me realize that we just got so excited to talk about what you designed for us. We just jumped right in and we didn't talk at all about your process because we didn't just start by being like, oh, this is Fairy Forest and doing that. You're right. It was very collaborative. It was very iterative. How long did we spend going back and forth on this and figuring out what types of trees to plant and what types of things? And have you ever thought of a hammock circle? And like just all of these different things that we'd never considered. And you teaching us about things like edging. So do you want to talk about the process? Because I do realize I just jumped right into like the fun areas and how we got the fun areas. Because
sure, yeah.
I could learn so much from you through that process. And it did take a lot of like, wow, this is a lot of information we've never considered before. And we need to think through it, especially because we want it to be what we want it to be. And I guess the funny part about that is like we've redone almost everything multiple times now. But kick us off, Fred. Talk to us about the process. How did you get us from nothing to something meaningful and beautiful?
Sure. Well, like I said, we already kind of covered your goals, right? Just trying to understand who's going to be out there, what you're going to be doing, what it is you want to be doing in a month and in 10 years. And so those get all wrapped up in the goals. And then just doing a really thorough analysis of the landscape, understand where the water's flowing, where the wind is blowing, where the sun is shining, where people are circulating, all that, right? How many horses are you going to have on the property? How many chickens? All those things come into play. How much food do you want to grow on the landscape? So all of that's part of the inventory and analysis. And so that's, you know, that's the first part. And then that creates just this measure that we're always going against. And we find out also what some of the limiting factors are. Those limiting factors really can help drive design decisions when you have all of these things that are possible. So some of the challenges that you had is that wind out on the farm is just crazy. It's always blowing. And because of that, you've got a gravel road that runs right by it. You want some sort of dust barrier, of course, along that gravel road. But then safety was an issue too. I mean, you described it well. You're in the middle of soybean and corn country, and there's herbicides and being sprayed quite a bit. So you wanted some sort of pesticide drift barrier. And so all those things started just really informing the design. Where are the kids going to be playing so that they're safe? What can we put up in the short term and long term so that it blocks that pesticide drift that might be coming your way? And so all that goes into that inventory assessment. And then the next step is what I call the concept design phase. And landscape design is just like designing a house or designing anything else. You kind of go through these same phases, just has different focuses. And so the next phase, concept design. And so we just looked at the big picture of the areas that you wanted. Like you wanted a playscape, you wanted a CSA garden. Obviously, you wanted your house to be a built place where your horses could roam, and an orchard of some kind. And so all those are just different areas. And we just started playing around with where those areas might live. I know one time we had a playscape up closer to the entrance because you were talking about inviting other families to the space. And so we fiddle around with that because it'd be easier for them to come just right in to the property and access the playscape right at the front of the property. But we decided, no, it'd probably be better back in where it is now, because Fairy Forest was a playscape is already there. Just felt better back there. And so we moved things around a lot around with these concepts. And I think at one time he wanted a natural swimming pool out there. I think that was Tom's dream. And somewhere along the line, I don't remember, that kind of got dropped or just kind of pushed to the back burner. I can't remember if that lived anywhere in the end. But those were the things that got to be explored during the concept design phase, being able to just walk around the property and say, okay, we want a natural pool. We want a playscape. We want this, we want that. And then just going out on the property, roaming around, just saying, is this the best spot for it? And after we get, I think we got like 3 or 4 different concepts created. And then we landed on a final concept. And that created this, just this big picture of where everything should reside. And once we have that big picture, it's much easier to decide where to put plant friends that you bring home from the nursery, right? We all have that. When we go out and we find a new plant friend or browse around online, find something we got to bring home. When we have this big concept already in place, then we know, okay, we got an apple tree. Well, that's going to go somewhere in the orchard. So if we got this thing, we put it in the orchard area. And so we start with the big picture, this concept design, and then work our way down to the details. So yeah, after that, we come up with the next phase is what's called a preliminary design. And that's just roughing, taking that rough concept design and actually saying, this is roughly where building structures are going to go, where pathways are going to reside. And we sketch in the rough sizes of those elements. And then the next phase is just refining those details even more, called the master plan. And Mandy, I said over and over again, master plan is really just, it's a misnomer. It's never done. It's always going to change. Your goals always, people's goals always change, and get new ideas as time goes on. We do the best we can with what we have at the time. And so we just say, this is the master plan, and it comes with a planting plan, number of plants to get, where to get them, all that. And then we come up with actual establishment plan as well, saying, okay, this is going to be a 1 month deal or a 10-year deal, and try to break everything out by season across 1 or more years. So that's the general process. What are your thoughts on that? What did I miss?
I guess when you're talking about it, Fred, I'm like, how long did it take us to go through that process? And then like, how long does it take normally to go through that process? Or when would you advise people to do this on their farm? Because I think that we felt like we need trees here and we need them yesterday or 10 years ago. Like, and so we felt very motivated to be planting trees. But I'm just curious on your thoughts on the timeline.
It's going to vary with everyone. You folks, you Webbers, you get things done fast. And so when you decide you're going to do something, you just immediately start digging the hole and putting a plant there. And so as soon as you knew, if I remember right, as soon as you knew there were going to be elderberries somewhere, elderberries. As soon as you knew where the chicken run was going to be, you started ordering fences and putting them up. And so I could barely keep up with you and your desire to get things going immediately. And so the design process, inventory and assessment, design process, all that, I can't remember the exact time frame, but it probably took at least a couple months, maybe 3 months from my very first visit to the very end, where I was saying, okay, this is probably the master plan. We can tweak some little details later, but it's probably at least 3 months.
I guess I'm also like, do you think it's a good idea for people to do it how we did, where it was like right when we first moved, or live on the property and get to know it a little bit first?
That's a great question. I would always, always advise folks to hold off on the design for as long as possible. And maybe, you know, everybody's got the itch to put things in the ground. Find a nursery, find a temporary spot, put those things in the ground that you really want. And then hopefully it'll be the right spot. Make your best guess. The best thing, the best approach is really live there for at least, you know, a year through all the seasons. So you can just kind of see again, where you're moving around on the property, really get a sense of where the sun is shining. You're going to learn so much from that process that can inform the design. Also learn about which weeds are going to be really difficult to manage. And that can also inform where you place things as well. So I know you had that initial orchard established, that, and that is something you're really hesitant to move for a good reason. I mean, you had plants in the ground that were growing and you didn't want to move those things. And I think I reframed it as saying, well, that was your plant nursery. And that helped incentivize you to possibly move those plants elsewhere.
Yeah, I got really excited about that idea. I was like, this is brilliant. We need to move the orchard to the kids' area so that way they can harvest the things when they're playing. And I think the resistance came from, not trying to blast Tom, but you were...
Oh, I was totally resistant.
To Fred's point, rightfully so. It was a lot of work that we put literally into the ground.
Yeah.
But are you happy that we moved it now? Or like...
Well, at the time, the certain cultivars that we had were on the plan meant to go into a future orchard that was part of the where the blackberries are. And so when we broke it down, the gazebo project.
Yeah.
And so looking at the cultivars that we planted and where they were going to end up on the property, I'm like, are we literally just going to move this 50 feet? Because all the ones that we talked about down by the kids area, those were all different cultivars that we haven't had bought at the time. And so you both looked at me and you're like, but it's going to be great. Come on. Talking 50 feet. Like,
this might not make as much sense to people that haven't seen the plan. Actually planted 20 plus trees to then dig them up. But I think there's wisdom in what Fred's sharing, which is if you could just tamper your excitement a little bit and live on the property and chew on ideas before we go dig holes. I think that's one of the biggest lessons that we've learned.
Yes. And this specific instance brought up a good point, because Fred had talked about, we got a crash course education in permaculture principles, which we thought we were doing the right thing with how we planted our orchard, the NAP principle, right? Along with some buddies around the area. And that's right after we had just got done doing that is when Fred came on board and we did the master plan approach, which involved we should move these 50 feet. So to that point of Fred just mentioning, like, if you live at the property for a year and get some seasons under your belt, you know, you start to realize how the things are flowing on your property, how you use the property, all the things he had just mentioned. And yes, maybe we wouldn't have planted them there right when we got here. But I'm glad that we moved it. I'm glad that we changed my mindset amongst it, because one, it gave our horses a winter paddock that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And they utilize it all the time. It also allows us to have the kids walk the horses in that area.
Mm-hmm. You know,
we can look right out the window and see it all happening. So yeah, hindsight being 2020, I'm happy that I changed my mind.
And I think there is something said too about like how the older farms set up fences from the beginning, because like that's exactly where the fence was, right where
we literally put it right back.
Yeah. So
tore it down and put it right
there's back. There's things, and now granted that was like an older fence and just things like that too, but I think that there is some wisdom whether they knew it or not, and I know that it wasn't as permaculture minded when they did it, but like there's reasons that they did that stuff, right? And I think it was because it was square off the barn, so that made a ton of sense, and it was also where that last tree was. So that's definitely a learning. The orchard was a fun little whoops project, and then it kind of became an inside joke between the three of us that we love to do everything twice at a minimum. So, but I think that this gets to like people, Fred, that get very frustrated about gardening, or they think that they failed, or, you know, this like, I'm not going to do it right mentality. So I'm just not going to do it. And I think for better or worse, that's never really been our mentality. It's just like, we're going to do it and it's going to be great. And if it's not, we're going to rip it out and do it again.
Yeah. As long as you're enjoying the whole process, that's all that really matters. And these spaces that you're talking about with the orchard, it would have been fine where it was. It would have been just fine. We introduced some new concepts to say, well, what if we reimagined this space? And we had a gathering area and the playscape area. And what if some of those plants live there? And or the permaculture principle is multiple functions. So we're taking a space and saying, instead of it just being an orchard, it's going to be a gathering area and an orchard. It's going to be a playscape and an orchard at the same time. So we're just stacking functions in those areas. And the more functions we can stack in an area, the more times we get to visit it, the more functions it creates for itself. And it tends to create more of a landscape that is easier to maintain because of that. So if you would have created that gathering area with those fruit trees around it, you would have been out there more and you would have tended the fruit trees more and you would have harvested from the trees more because you're simply out there hanging out in the space, grilling, you know, making s'mores. And on the playscape, right, the fruit trees that you did plant there give much more attention because you and the kids are in that playscape more often.
Right. So the place that we're speaking of now is where the gazebo was originally designed to be in the initial orchard, which now houses our
actual garden,
which is vastly different than the plan. So I think the year that we did this with you, Fred, we planted it there because we buried the electric line and we said, let's just take advantage of the fact that the ground's already tore up and a mess. So we're just going to plant here this year. And it's literally exactly where our garden is today.
And that was absolutely the right decision. A kitchen garden or a cutting garden or any garden that is going to require more pampering or more visits, getting that as close to where you recreate is really important. You can look right outside your kitchen window and see that garden is right there. And he's just a few steps away from your kitchen. So that is absolutely the right place to put it. And oftentimes those in-ground beds, those can just be temporary and that's what you have, right? So they can just be a temporary location for vegetable grounds. But vegetable grounds are pretty easy to move. When you get a raised bed, that becomes a little more difficult. Or large containers, or even small containers, just creating those right outside the back door can be a placeholder until you decide you have the time or money to figure out where to establish a larger garden.
Yes, Fred, 4 years later, having the garden right back where we started, I 100% agree with you.
Well, if I remember right, the kitchen garden in the original plan, for the original house, it was going to be right up next to the house. We kind of sketched something in that was really rough because, again, we didn't know exactly what the house was going to look like. We had a rough blueprint, but that was in flux. And so that was the original thought for the kitchen garden, was up next to your house. And that's all you've done now is in your trailer, you've got a kitchen garden right up next to your house.
But it wouldn't be us without dreaming a little bit bigger, though, Fred. Because remember, we had that CSA garden in the back, and we thought, we're going to start a CSA garden. We're going to sell chickens and eggs and produce and do this whole model. And we just never took off with that and realized that having a garden that big and that far away from our house
was very hard to maintain.
Big time. So there's something to be said about these zones, Fred, and keeping them close and in sight. Because to your point, like, I can look out my window and see a red tomato. I'm like, ooh,
go grab
that tomato, guys, and check everything for tomatoes. And while you're out there, look for blackberries. And now we're going to have BLTs for supper. Like, that's what we're doing. And I wasn't able to see that or have those thoughts or check on the tomatoes as top of mind when it was way back behind my shop, right? So I love looking out and seeing the garden. And even just, we threw an old cattle panel in an arch. Just a little thing like that, and then grew cucumbers over it, and they went gangbusters this year. And just like that, it was an old rusty cattle panel that's been sitting here since we bought the property. And that is the best utilization of it because it brought so much joy to our family this year. And it just is a simple hack. I loved it.
Yay for use. It is amazing to me, even after all these years, how placing things closer makes them vastly easier to access and lowers the maintenance of a landscape exponentially. I've got three little gardens in my landscape, and one resides, my landscape's really small. One resides behind my garage, but the one behind my garage, literally just 50 feet away from my kitchen garden that I go into every day, I will visit that one behind my garage, you know, maybe once, twice a week, and I'll be in my kitchen garden two or three times a day. And it's not because I can't just take a few more steps to get back there, but like you say, it's out of sight, out of mind. And just those few extra feet really make a huge difference in how well a garden is maintained. And just closer you can get it, the lower the maintenance of that landscape will be. Proximity is really important.
I think we learned that the hard way, and we're so grateful. Anything you want to add about gardens, Tom?
Well, not necessarily on the gardens, but I have a couple of points that I think were very monumental, so to speak. Number one was just the amount of information that Fred provided in our plan. I mean, we learned so much about so many different plants that he had a comprehensive list. And we looked at it and we're like, we're going to be planting 384 what grass? And then we just look back at the plan and we're like, where the heck are all these going? And so then we started doing the math and we're like, okay, now I see why we'd be planting 300 some out of these certain type of grass for the pesticide drift barrier. And so we learned way more than what we ever probably even thought we would learn from this process. Not to mention, we are still learning just by doing the process. So one, I want to give Fred mad kudos because he gave us so much to digest in a very comprehensive package that I think was worth its weight in gold, honestly. So yes, Fred, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Echo, for sure.
My pleasure. I learned a lot too. Yeah, and that's the thing that makes backyard abundance really unique in what we do. It's really one-on-one education. It's just like a big class that lasts weeks. And so we provide every single ounce of inspiration, every single bit of knowledge that we possibly have about what's going into this design process, what the rationale is for design decisions, plant decisions, all that goes into this plan. So that you feel really confident when backyard abundance steps away, you'll feel have the confidence to be able to make design decisions on your own. Because the design, like I said, the design will change. It's a master plan, it's static right now, looks great. But we want to leave everyone with the knowledge how this thing came together, what the rationale was behind every single design decision, so that you can feel confident to make changes or feel confident in why changes or why decisions were made to begin with.
Yeah, it was awesome, Fred. And we're still going back and referencing those things like edging. How could we do that better where we're not dealing with weeds creeping into things? One of the biggest areas that we focused on with you, Fred, was like the chicken paddocks. We really wanted to get the chickens in, not so much in like, we don't want them to free range. We did want them to, but there's a lot of predator pressure out here. And then we also realized like they were laying eggs in the shop and like we were finding things in the toolboxes. And it was like, okay, we don't need every day to be an Easter egg hunt. Like we need them for eggs and we need to know where the eggs are. So it became apparent that we really wanted a paddock system, but instead of just locking them in somewhere, right? Like we wanted them to be nice sized and then to have edibles in there for them. So that way there was fruit dropping and it was really like a big composting operation. So do you want to talk to us about how that was designed? Cause I'm happy to report that actually like 80% of that is in place. Like the whole outside is lined with elderberries. We have cherry trees in the one paddock. We couldn't keep anything alive in that south paddock closest to the shop because they just went nuts for jostaberries and all those little berry bushes that you had us plant. And we did it twice, Fred, and they just
eviscerated it.
Yeah, kept eating them. Well, we got a hazelnut and like the happiest crabapple tree you've ever seen in the other paddock. So I think they're doing really well.
What's that little Japanese tree we have in there?
Like some weeping cherry tree that I found on sale that I just was like, to Fred's point, sometimes you just leave nurseries and you're like, yep, I'm taking this one with me.
It's a super adorable little tree that they actually love. They hide under there and it provides great shade for them because it just, it hangs on the ground low and just weeps all over them and they can't get enough of it. They run amok and you see them, you know, dive and dart inside there. And, but yeah, they just eviscerated everything else. We didn't even get a chance, like, the problem was we didn't have a gate that we could section them off because Fred, you had a great idea of, hey, have a seasonal rotation, which if you want to talk about kind of that process and the mentality of it would be awesome, but we just couldn't keep up with them.
And I know that pushed Fred a lot too, because this was pretty outside of your realm, Fred.
Yeah, I learned a ton. I love designing the chickens paddocks and the horse paddocks because I got to learn all about chickens and horses and I designed small chicken runs before, but nothing like this. And yeah, Tom, like you said, we designed it for seasonal rotation. So they would go through these three different paddocks through the season and they would eat one way down and then move on to the next one, eat that one way down and move on to the next one. While they were in those other paddocks, the other ones could take time to recover. It doesn't sound like their recovery period was very successful. But there are two goals. One was to have these paddocks set up with perennials, fruits and grasses and things like that, where it would help feed the chickens without your effort, right? So elderberries, when they are producing, they just drop those berries on the ground. We had crab apples in there and cherries, like you said. And service berries. And the idea was that if the flying birds didn't get them, then they would drop to the ground and feed the chickens. So that was one goal. And the other goal was to provide cover for the chickens as well. So we had hazelnuts in there because hazels are pretty dense and they could hide under those pretty easily. And so there's just a lot of cover. I think the service berries provided some cover as well. So those are the goals, which is to rotate them through these three paddocks and provide some food and cover for them.
Cover from both the elements and the sun and from predators. Like we have a lot of hawks, a lot of eagles. And so it was great to get actual coverage from multiple things for them because they do spend a lot of time outside. And to Tom's point, they just duck under a tree like if they feel a threat or something. But chicken paddocks, I think, are wildly successful. Elderberries, we found a sign at a vintage shop when we were thrifting one day, Fred, that said Elder Lane. And so now that's lovingly called Elder Lane. And we have that sign up, but
perfect.
It's a cute, fun area. And it's fun to harvest so many things from your own property. So that's really chickens and horses you talked about. We haven't planted anything in the horse paddocks or the dust protection or the dust barrier over that way. We kind of focused money, time, and effort, to your point, like closer to the house instead of out in the fields. That said, probably the biggest place we focused when we were done interacting with you was the kids area. I love talking about natural playscapes, and the kids were little and this was really fun. Before we even engaged Fred, we had the mud kitchen in the row of Eastern Pines, kind of where the dubbed like kids area is. But Fred kind of helped us open it up to like get an arbor. And he made this really beautiful, like concentric three circle cohesive thing coming together. And Tom and I edged that with bricks. And then we edged it with tree branches that had fallen down and made an inside space. We even had all the wood to build a stage at one point. And
we still have it.
We do. It's just in a pile. It's not being used. But I think, Fred, what we learned was the concept of having it inside of the arbor was really beautiful, but I could not get my mower through there. And last year when the baby was born, that area just went completely overgrown. Like I'm talking 3-4 foot super thick weeds and thistles, and it was a disaster and hard to get back. Fortunately, the kids fell in love with playing in the hay mound. So they didn't really miss it, but it just was such an eyesore and so hard. I know you got to see it like that at one point this summer. And we actually had a kid help us over the summer, like reclaim that area. So it's back. We pulled all the edging out of there and just said, you know what? It's just going to be an open space with grass. And I have to be able to mow it to maintain it, because I think that's kind of another lesson we learned, is that just if you go too fast, it's really hard to keep up with. It's a lot easier to get stuff in the ground than it is to maintain everything around it. So I'm curious if either of you have anything to add to any of that, but
I can speak to the design elements of it and what the intention was, the original intention. I love arbors. They're great for what's called wayfinding, being able to look across a way, go, oh, that's where it's supposed to go. We've all walked up to a building and we're not quite sure where the entrance is. That's an example of lousy wayfinding. Or when we walk into a store and we just have a sense of where we're supposed to go to find stuff. That's an example of a good wayfinding. An arbor is a classic way to create good wayfinding in the landscape. So that's one really great function of them. So if they kids come out the back door, they can look down the way and say, okay, that's where I'm supposed to go. That's my space. And the arbor makes it feel like it's a special space. Like when they're walking into it, this is their space. And I think you even had a sign on it or something like that. So it'd be like, no rules past this point or something like that.
Everything, the yes, this way, right? And it was because we had edibles and things. And so I was like, I don't expect to harvest anything out of this area. Like if it's all used for Mud Kitchen, I'm cool with it. If they bring an apple in or they snack on it, amazing. But I had no expectation of harvesting any of that. And I didn't really care if they were just pulling it off to make pancakes or whatever they were doing in the Mud Kitchen that day, you know? But yeah, I just wanted it to be an area where it's like, if they want to jump off this stump or climb these trees, or I don't know, they'll just like randomly grab shovels and wheelbarrows and be out in that area, right? And it's like, we've kind of got this like mulched area, and I'm like, I don't really care if you dig a monster random hole in the mulch area, you know? But so they, yeah, the answer is yes, beyond the arbor. And it always has been. And I like that they know this is my zone where I can do whatever I want, and it can be whatever I want it to be.
Kids are so creative, especially when they're given a lot of space and a lot of loose parts. So in playscape design, there's a concept where you just have a space where you just dump a bunch of stuff. It can be seasonal stuff. So in Christmas time, that's where the oldie goes. In Halloween time, that's where the jack-o'-lantern is going. In summertime, that's where a bunch of old logs go or something like that. And then kids just go crazy assembling those things for whatever, you know, their dramatic play or living out scenarios. These are the things that you don't find in conventional playscapes. Conventional playscapes really just built for a lot of recreational needs, a lot of big movements, a lot of physical exercise, but they don't always engage kids' minds. And by one of the greatest ways to do that is with these loose parts, because then they just get really creative and assemble those parts. And so she's having things like a mud kitchen, you know, just a countertop. That's all it takes. And they'll go to town, create everything else. And having just stumps in the ground, they'll, you know, create all kinds of crazy things, or tree cookies, you know, they can stack up and move around, or just create pathways. Those are the things that engage their imagination. And you talked about a stage, same thing. I think in the design, there was also a music area on the stage so they could make music and make plays with the music while they're there. There's just all kinds of things that are placed into that natural playscape that would engage both their bodies and their minds.
Yeah. And I mean, Fred, to your point, even just getting a pile of rock or a pile of mulch or a pile of sand or a pile of dirt, that keeps them busy for months. Like they just, that's their pile, you know, and they just go crazy with it. And it's actually like our project pile where we're trying to distribute it, but it was hours and hours of entertainment for them. And I mean, to your point too about a mud kitchen, it can be as simple as take an old pallet and make that into a mud kitchen, cut a hole and drop a bowl. Like, and or go to the Dollar Tree or ask people that are getting married or people that are like upgrading their kitchen stuff for their old things. I mean, that's how we got a lot of our stuff. And they don't need special things. It's getting rained on. It's in the elements, you know? It doesn't need to be top-notch anything, just old stuff that they get to go crazy with. And if it busts or rusts out, you just dispose of it properly and move on. But what do you think, Tom, about kids' playscapes?
Yeah, don't give them a bunch of bougie stuff because it ends up in the dirt anyways. The playscape has been, honestly, one of the more fun areas to continually improve upon. And it's fun to watch them experience that throughout the seasons. I can't tell you how many times that I'll catch them just jumping from log to log, yelling, parkour, parkour. They think they're doing some crazy, awesome, you know, maneuvers and stuff. And for them, it's working on their coordination, their balance, their gameplay, their, you know, creativity. Like Fred said, just it expands constantly and over again. Where one day they're doing something, the next day that's completely different with the same stuff. But to Mandy's point too, is just like past the zone is a yes. So feel free to create, to destroy and create again, to destroy and create again, and manipulate how you want. And when you have play dates with other kids and other families that come, they go gangbusters just as hard. Because I think for a lot of kids who don't get to experience that in a more, you know, time on or hands on approach, they, for a second, they're kind of like, what do we do? And then all of a sudden they explode and there's just creativity bursting at the seams. And so it's exciting to see kids using their imaginations again instead of just being stuck behind a screen. But I think the cool thing that evolved out of this was Mandy out of the blue calls me up and says, hey, I got something that I think is going to be awesome. I'm like, what did you get? And she says, well, I happen to find a culvert for free. And I go, what? She's like, yeah, like a gigantic concrete culvert that just guys just wants to give it away. We got to go pick it up. I'm like, okay. What are we going to do with it? It's going to be like a tunnel. And it's going to, I think we're going to just make like a mound over the top of it. Okay. Sounds interesting.
Like an earth mound.
Yeah. This thing is massive. Like almost a 4-foot kid can walk through this thing standing up. It's huge. And yeah, we buried it. And then we put a freaking massive tractor tire in front of it as like a, almost like a buffer or like a safety buffer.
Dad comes over to place it for us with a backhoe. And I'm like, hey, Dad, before you drop it, I want that tractor tire on the front of it. He's like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
That
I'm like,
gonna fit.
That's going to happen. That's the ultimate entrance to this. And our daughter was like, Grandpa, don't you think you could just use a chainsaw to take the wire off? And we were like, that's how you do it. Like, that's going to be awesome. But I think it's going around just salvaging parts. Like,
yeah.
That should have not been a complete surprise because I think you knew I was looking for something like that. And it was every job site I was driving by, I'm like, one of those has got to be chipped. They got to be able to not use one of them, right? Like, how do I get one? And just looking for parts. I mean, you could go to a tire store and get tires for free. They pay to get those taken away. And I've seen people fill those with sand and make like stairs and stuff. So just be creative. You don't have to have thousands of dollars to make a natural playscape for children. You can do it with materials that people are throwing away. You can do it with materials that are free or easily accessible or ones that you already have. That's what I love about natural playscapes. And every natural playscape is going to be unique to the materials you have, the kids' interests, the time and capacity that you have. But you can make something that they can play with and explore. And what I also love about this is it encourages them like to learn risk-taking on their own, right? Like, they're only going to learn so much of that by us being like, be careful. Oh, don't do that. You might fall. Well, you know what's going to teach a kid that? Actually falling out of a tree, right? Like, and then they're going to realize, I should have trusted my gut when I felt like that branch was unstable. It actually takes like nothing from us. And even supervision, then, you know, it's like when they fall, you okay? all right, back at it, you know, and maybe like a hug and a kiss, but it's like, I got to get back up there because now I know exactly what branch to step on. So it's things like that that I love about these natural playscapes. And part of what I hate about how they're doing natural playscapes in like communities, I get excited about it, but it's also like, this shouldn't be thousands of dollars, and not every stick should be so sanded that it doesn't even feel like a stick anymore. You know, like, it's okay to interact with natural materials and to get sticky, to get dirty. That is why modern Americans have washing machines.
Yeah, your natural playscape should come with a waiver.
I just think it's fun. It's childhood to get dirty. And that's kind of the mindset that we have here, is like, go play, go be a kid, go get dirty, go break some stuff. And when you're done, we'll wash you off with a hose and put you in the bath. Like, you'll be all good. It'll be fun. But Fred, you helped us create so many of these amazing areas. And I know that you had a childhood similar to this, like creek stomping and growing up. Do you want to talk about natural playscapes at all? Or is there anything you want to add?
Sure. Yeah. Well, everything you and Tom are talking about, I completely agree with. And we humans are so successful in our endeavors across the earth over so many generations, for hundreds of thousands of years, because we played outside. That is why we are so successful as a species, because we learned a lot of limitations. We took risks. We interacted and played and made things up and told stories. And we didn't do all that in sterile environments and sterile boxes. We did it outside, under the moon, under the stars, under the sun. That's why we're so successful. And so the more we can recreate spaces like that that they're safe, right? We want to create scaffolding that isn't really high, you know, kind of low for these spaces, so that when kids do fall, they're not falling a long ways, or they're falling on something that's padded, right? So we, of course, want to be conscientious about what we're designing. But then, yeah, let them just go to town. Let them dig. Let them be creative. And that's how we have done it for hundreds of thousands of years. And it's worked really well for us. And so that's all we're recreating now in these environments. And yeah, I grew up in Itamosa, which has Wapsipunikan State Park in it. And that park made me. That was the thing where I took my best buddies. We went out there and we fished and swam and got poison ivy and got our rashes from running around all over the place. And that's why I am who I am, because I had a really early introduction to natural places, and that just was embedded in me. And so when I go into a natural area, I'm really comfortable with being in that space, because I grew up in spaces like that. I grew up rolling around in the Wapsipunikan State Park. And for those of you who are in the Iowa area, if you get a chance, go to Wapsie Park. It's a fantastic park. It's got rivers in the little valley. It's got a river going through it. Lots of fun places to roam around.
See, Fred, that's what I love. Like, you talk about this like it was yesterday. That's why we engaged you in Backyard Abundance. That's why we wanted help doing this. I want our kids to talk about these play areas and the farm they grew up on in that same way. You know, just like,
I had an opportunity this summer to take Taproot Nature Experience to Wapsipunikan State Park. They hadn't been there before, and they met me there, and we did some foraging there, and it just really, it was just a really heartfelt experience for me to, after 55 years to, you know, after 50 years, to go back and be able to teach kids that were my age when I grew up there, things that I learned while I was there. And it just really warmed my heart to be able to do that.
That's amazing, Fred. I love that. I think the playscapes, I mean, despite the fact that they were completely run over by weeds after we had our third, they're a smashing success. Like, all the kids like to play at them. They're now maintained again. And I mean, the day we started like really getting after it, it was like everything in the kids was like, man, did I miss this? And it was just boom, they were right over there like a swarm of bees, you know? So
Yeah, you had a, everybody has a point where their garden just gets out of control. And that's just fine. It just happens. That's called life.
Yeah.
And those times, those are when you're making wildlife really happy. You've created a great wildlife refuge and it's a soil building year. Call it that. All those weeds are building soil and providing wildlife habitat.
We didn't kill and have a baby. We had a soil building year. I love that, Fred.
I do too. And what's fun about this place is we always knew that no matter what we put in the ground was going to go crazy, because whenever we put a shovel in the ground, worms everywhere. It's such rich, nutrient dense soil. And Iowa's got tons of that, but not every pocket of Iowa, but we happen to have a nice little pocket. Speaking of the weeds, this is, I think, one of the biggest takeaways that we learned about implementing the plan, taking the information and the knowledge and understanding how we can go about this. So we had so many garden beds around the property, and we had mountains and mountains of mulch ready to be placed. I mean, I think you told us you can never have enough mulch. At our old house, I hated mulch. I was like, let's take all the mulch out and put rock in.
He did do that.
So we did that. And now I'm like, mulch is the best thing in the world. Because what's great about mulch is every now and again, you get beautiful little mushrooms that just pop up. And it's like a little extra delight, especially in fairy forest. I'm like, this just feels right. That there's just mushrooms growing and just for fun. But no, I think what we learned is that putting all that weed mat down didn't do a dang thing.
I don't think we'll put
weed
mat down.
We are done doing weed mat. It is just a waste of money, resources, and time, because it never worked unless you were willing to spend three times as much to put down three times as much weed mat. Maybe then it would work, but we were like, nah, yeah, one roll out, we should be fine.
To be fair, Fred, I don't think you told us to put weed mat down. I think we were trying to shortcut.
Right. What he told us was
cardboard. Fred, give us the official recommendation here. What would you do legitimately?
Now, weed mats are fantastic for temporary situations. So if you're trying to smother some weed, like poison ivy or something like that, put it down for a year or two, but then you pull it back up. Some friends of mine use it in their pathways. They just want to have permanently mulched pathways. And so they'll get the most durable weed fabric they can find, put it down, put wood chips over it. And then every 2 years, they pull that weed fabric up, shake it out. If it's still good, they'll put it back down, cover it with wood chips. But then after about 4 or 5 years, they just need to replace it. So fantastic as a temporary weed barrier. But long term, like you experience, and like everyone experiences, that weed mat just becomes more of a hassle than it does a help. And so mulch is your best friend. And there's a technique called cheap mulching. It's not rocket science. You basically just put bare minimum is just putting down a cardboard or a contractor's paper, that floor protection paper you can find in the painting aisle at hardware stores. Roll that stuff out and then put mulch down. Mulch is fantastic because it'll grow mushrooms, but more importantly, it's going to grow soil, going to protect all the soil organisms. And the more you put down, just buys you time. So 4 inches, depending on your soil, that might buy you a year. Put down 8 inches, that might buy you 2 or 3 years. And if at that time you're still not ready to plant or do something, pile on more mulch. And if you need to take a break from gardening for a while, pile on the mulch. And it can be wood chips or it can be straw. Right? It's just a fantastic resource.
Awesome. Fred, one other thing I just want to talk about in terms of like the property and things that we've actually done, like in reality, and this is Tom inspired. Tom loves to do like the water elements and the lighting and what we call area beautification. So we find these little pockets like on the side of the shop between like the garage door and the walking door, right? It's like this little 30-foot thing. We could edge this and plant some things because nurseries are having sales right now. Let's do that this weekend. And so we just call them like little area beautification projects and get after them. But do you want to talk at all about that, Tom? Because we've probably run about 6 of those now.
Are you talking about my oops?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
I thought you were talking about the time that you were like, hey, make this little garden bed right here next to the shop. And I was like, okay, cool. And so I ripped that up. But then I'm like,
Oh, the wind all this didn't just stop.
I just went the
whole length of the shop.
We were like, wait, what?
I just didn't have enough plants for that, but we went and got some.
What was your original question, though?
You get really giddy about area beautification projects.
Yes. I think because, like to Fred's point, you can design whenever you want, however you want. So why not? You know, is a design always ever flowing and ever creating? Maybe. Or is the design a one-time thing? Maybe. But what I think we've found out while we've been going through this is we have our one-time design stuff, but we've also got the recreation of certain areas. Because we've taken old, what we perceived were old landscaped parts and ripped it out for good reasons, but recreated. What I think is pretty exciting about just what we've been doing is incorporating different elements within. So what I like to see is height variations of plants, because it's like they bloom at different times and different pops of color bloom at different times. And so that play and that contrast and when things are hitting at the right times, to me, that's been fun. Not only to see when it's in full bloom, but also to see how they progress. I think I've been blown away with how much stuff sprawls, where you're like, oh, it's only going to get to be about 2 feet wide. Well, 6 feet later, you're like, I think we need to trim this thing back.
Totally. It feels weird when you're planting and it's like you have one here, and you're like, man, that feels unnecessarily large. But I think you really just need to trust people like Fred when they're giving you advice like that, because they will get there and you're going to wish that they were spaced properly, like you were told initially. I don't know. There's just so much that we've learned. I guess, do we all just want to share like the biggest thing that we've learned or takeaway from doing the project, or how it stands today, or what's left the biggest impression? Fred, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you two are so inspiring. Just you get after it, you have a vision, and once you get that vision, just you're unstoppable. And that's what I really appreciated about just collaborating with you on this design. Is it's almost as if, you know, we're designing sometimes and you're unfolding that design as I was designing it. So it's just a joy to see those things unfold. And you know, you talked, one other thing I want to mention is about the weediness of a landscape. And we all have landscapes, like I said, to get away from us. And gardening, for me, has always been something that is a joyful experience. And we've got enough in this culture that wants to shame us and make us feel guilty. Let's not make gardening one of those things. Let's make gardening fun, enjoyable. And if it does get away from us, just say, well, it's just, you know, it's just something else. I can throw mulch on it or whatever. Don't just, if I could wave my magic wand and just say, let's have gardening not be one of those things that makes us feel shame or guilt, because there's plenty in the world that'll do that. Let's not make gardening one of those things. Boy, that would go a long way to making our world a better place.
Amen, Fred. We could have used a dose of that for sure. Thank you for sharing that, because I think that we've learned so much from you as well. Like, I think this project equally pushed both of us, like you in knowledge of animals and rotational grazing and things like that, and us in terms of like, we're planting things like jostaberries and serviceberries and currants, which are now like three of the kids' favorite things to eat. That even when you were recommending them, I'm like, really, Fred? Like, what is this? And we just were like, whatever, diversity. Let's get it in and do it. And the kids are just snack. I mean, I thought we were going to harvest enough currants to be able to make jelly, but they couldn't stop eating them. And I would have never guessed that 4 years ago when you made that recommendation. So little things like that have just been pleasant surprises. And also, like, I think one of my goals has morphed into like, I want to be able to go out and pick a bouquet no matter what day of the year it is. And that's kind of what Tom was talking about too, with like seasonal flowers and height variations and colors and things. And it's just so fun that whenever somebody comes over here, it's like, here, you get a dozen eggs, and we'll tell the kids like, oh, Fred's coming over, go pick a bouquet quick. And they'll just run around and see what they can grab, you know? And I just think that that is so fun. Honey, what about for you?
Fred, we'll have to show you this picture or video I think we have of our youngest. You know, as a one-year-old, he's got this little blue car that we push him around in the property where the kids do. And the the funnest thing to see him was when the currants were blooming like crazy and they had berries like, whoa. The kids would park him up next to this little bush and he would just sit there and pluck, ow, pluck, ow. Not, you could just leave him there for an hour and he wouldn't be happy as a clam. So the currant bush is hands down his favorite.
But it was because of that currant bush that he started to like plop out of it. Like, yeah. He was reaching so hard for the red ones that he couldn't reach.
It's been super fun.
What's your biggest lesson learned doing this project and boots on the ground, yeah, hands in the dirt?
I think I have a couple big takeaways. Number one, I think the joy of the design process was something I've never really fully experienced landscape design, like on this kind of scale. I really enjoyed it. I really dived into like the, what could we do?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that to me was exciting, of just like, you know, let's think of long-term, let's think of short-term, let's think of all the possibilities of what we want our outdoor life to look like and how we want to use these spaces. So that was so fun. Starting the implementation process of the plan, just having the plan was so, Fred, I mean, you talked about how we just get after implementation. Because we have the plan, we were able to do that pretty quickly. Without the plan, I think we would have been like, okay, we got this tree that we picked up. Where can it go? I don't know, over there. Well, with the plan, it's no, we know exactly what needs to be planted. Let's go find that bush or that tree. Hey, it's on sale. Get all of them for the plan. I mean, there was things that we planted that we had no idea were on our like quote unquote priority list until like they came on sale. And we're like, yep, we're getting all of them now.
Hitting 40 dogwoods this weekend.
So that's kind of how we went through that. But seeing what we could do, not only as a team, having the plan to do it was what made it go as fast as it could. We probably went a little too fast because we learned by going too fast, we couldn't maintain when life kind of comes at you. So I think the other big lesson or takeaway that I got from this was understanding that every time you make a new bed, you have to maintain said new bed. But throughout that process, we kind of got back to this, let's enjoy what we've put here. And we would take strolls around the property, and just by walking the land again, and just by, you know, taking down all the overgrowth and getting it back to the base again, just it kind of reinvigorates that joy of, hey, this is awesome. Let's maintain this a little better. And now we can plant a little something here and we can add to it or do whatever. But this whole process has also created this mantra that Manny and I share, which is the 1% method. Mm-hmm. And so I think if the listeners can take anything like through this process, it's the 1% method would be huge. What do I mean by the 1% method? It's the, if I could do something today that is just 1% more on XYZ, what is that going to be? And so for us, you know, when you think about the plan, it was, what's 1% I could do today? It's go around that corner of the barn and weed that little bed. That's 1% of the whole freaking property that you could be weeding, but that spot, it needs it. So do it. And it took 20 minutes or whatever. And so that mantra really, I think we stick by quite a bit. And when things feel chaotic, we just look at it and go, 1%, what are we going to do? Okay.
Yeah.
And so getting back to those routines of, hey, walk the property. And it's amazing just by walking the property that you'll find yourself getting after it again. When you didn't think you had time, guess what? You have time. So,
yeah, the 1%'s good. And I think it gets to the crux of like the implementation, right? So Fred gives this big plan and it looks beautiful and you're so excited. And then you can kind of get this analysis paralysis of like, where do I start? You know, like, what is the phases to do this? And that's kind of where it's, is it time? Is it money? Is it plants on sale? Like, and that's where Fred, I'm not even going to ask because I know you're going to say, it's going to be different for every single landscape. And there's truth to that, right? So I guess knowing all this, Fred, and the implementation and watching us do this firsthand and you having experience with other landscape design clients, I think you've kind of pivoted even on what you're offering, right? Because now you're doing a little bit more handholding with the services that you're offering. Do you want to talk about that for a second?
Sure, sure. Yeah. Tom, you spoke beautifully about just having a plan and why that's so helpful. It's also easier to prioritize things when you have a plan. So, and put it on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 to 10, whatever scale you want to put it on, then your landscape stops tugging at you quite so much. So those things that are a lower priority, the priority 5 and priority 10s, you can say, oh, those are things I'm going to do in a year or two. So you walk out your door and you see a blank spot or a weedy spot or something that you know is a lower priority, you just keep on walking and go to those places that are in that within that 1% that are higher priorities to go to. So that's another big thing that the design can help with is priority.
Those, like, what do we want to get done before the frost?
Yeah, exactly.
That I'm on, like, what's happening, or before the baby comes, or before the holidays, or before this, right? Like, so we try to create these goals. And to your point, it's easier to be like, we're not touching anything that way on the property. We're just focused on this right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Such solid advice, Fred. Thank you.
One of the things we found over the years of doing this, again, Backyard Defense has been around for almost 20 years now, and we found that folks have struggled with establishing the landscapes according to the plan, no matter how many educational resources I leave with them. Well, you know, the fact that I'm answering questions afterward, always available. Still, sometimes it's a struggle. So we started a coaching program that goes alongside the landscape design, and we piloted it earlier this year, and it was a really great success. And now it's just part of our mainstay offering. So people need help laying out the landscape, or if they need help just seeding a portion, or they need help just starting a garden bed or something like that, we offer these coaching services as well. So we'll come for an hour, hour and a half, or 2 hours and walk through whatever it is that needs to be walked through. So earlier this week, I was helping some folks lay out their landscape. We did a concept design of their entire backyard, and they just wanted help kind of laying out a space where they were going to gather. And so took tape measures and string and stakes and just went out and just kind of roughed the layout out. And took about an hour, hour and a half of just fun laying things out. That was what they were going to do, what we did. And then later this year, they want some help seeding their prairie. They've never done that before. And so I'm going to help them just seed their prairie and show them how to do it. And maybe we'll get the whole thing done, but I imagine if it's a bigger space, I'll just show them how to do it, and then they can do it after I leave. So that's our coaching services. And that has just been a resounding success. It's something that's been on our mind for years, and we've finally done it. And I'm really happy to be able to offer that.
I just can't even imagine where we would be if we would have taken you up on that part, Fred. Amazing. I'm so glad to hear you're offering that. And Fred, where can people find you? How can they get this done for their own landscape?
Sure. Yeah. Backyardabundance.org is the URL. We're changing our name to EarthMind, and EarthMindPractice.org will be what we are sometime in January or February of 2026. And both of the URLs will take you to the same place, but eventually we'll be called EarthMind Practice. And so that's where we're moving to. And I do want to mention too, if you want to look at Mandy's design, it's out on the website. Look for the design portfolio and you'll be able to see her landscape design out there, at least a high level 3D rendering of it.
I will link to everything in the show notes. And Fred, I know you've listened to the podcast a handful of times. You were actually on the podcast before. You're one of my most popular episodes, episode 3, Bloodlines and Storylines. You know that I ask everybody, what books are they reading? And just when you're doing something like this with us, like what you gave us so many books to look at, what are like your top 2 or 3 that you recommend?
The biggest one is Guy's Garden. That is a fantastic book about permaculture. It's home scale permaculture written by Toby Hemenway. If you're thinking about getting into permaculture, it's turned you on some way, orchards, perennial food, Guy's Garden is the best one to go to. If you're thinking about vegetable gardens, there's one called The Vegetable Gardener's Bible. That is a fantastic book. And my third recommendation is going to be very self-serving. Jen Cardos and I, my partner, I recently wrote a book called Low Maintenance Eco Gardens, and it's going to be available in February 2026. And it's a culmination of everything that she and I have learned over the course of 20 years. We try to pack all that into that book. And so it's a combination of not just vegetable gardening, but container gardening, raised bed gardening, things that just really make a landscape low maintenance. So it's even got wild edibles in there. So folks don't have time to do containers or raised beds, plant some gooseberries and serviceberries. And so we walk folks through just step by step how to do that. And the thing that Jen brings to it is woven throughout the whole thing is how to make the garden enjoyable. Like I was saying, we just reframe things. So you're talking about the 1% method. We call that the hula hoop method. So find a box or a hula hoop, throw it over the garden bed. That's all you're weeding. That's all you're doing, right, for that. So there's just all these little tips and tricks to make gardens just really manageable, but more so just really enjoyable, fun spaces to actually be in. So that would be my third book recommendation.
I'm glad you brought it up. So I was going to ask you next, Fred, but the book title one more time.
Low Maintenance Eco Gardens.
And it's available for pre-order right now. I will also link to that in the show notes. But Fred, I'm so proud of you. And I'm just so excited that there is such an affordable, readily available option that's about to hit that gives us access to the inner workings of you and Jen's brain. Like, what a blessing that is for the community and for just honestly anyone that's interested in gardening. So thank you and Jen for putting that out into the world and working so hard on it. I know it's been a labor of love and the culmination of your entire career and all that you know. So I'm just so excited for you and thrilled for you.
Dude, it's really difficult and I'm glad it's out there and over. And I'm so looking forward to it being in the world and people just creating abundance from it.
You just exude joy in all things landscaping and gardening, Fred. I'm sure it's going to just inspire the pants off of everybody. So I want to thank you not only for helping Eureka Moon Farm, Tom, myself, and the kids get to where we are with the happy and healthy earthlings here at Eureka Moon, but just who you are and what you do for the world and the community. Fred, you're awesome. And I'm just so thrilled that we started this partnership all those years ago. And it just was what started as a fun project. And now it's a working relationship and it's amazing. And I'm so grateful. So thank you so, so much, Fred.
Oh, you're very welcome. My pleasure. Your farm, your landscape, it's the epitome of why I started Backyard Abundance to begin with, is to help folks just like you establish these abundant spaces and not just feed us food, but feed our souls and help us live alongside all the other wildlife that's out there in harmony.
Thank you. And honey, thank you for helping me plant and make the plan that Fred, that we worked with him on, come to life. And it's just been fun getting things in the ground, and it has not been fun pulling them out. It's tested us a lot, but those were decisions that we made and probably things we should have listened to. But just thank you.
Anytime.
It's fun. We prefer to be outside. So doing stuff like this is a lot of fun. So I just want to thank you both so much for joining me here on the podcast and for all of your help and hard work. Thank you. Thank you.
Very welcome. Looking forward to the next time, Mandy. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, hon.
What a fun conversation with Tom and Fred. I love that it wasn't just about land or programs. It was about legacy, memory, and the quiet work of building something that matters over time. If Fred's words stir something in you, if you found yourself nodding along or remembering a piece of your own story, or maybe you're imagining what home could feel like for you, follow that. Reflect on it. Let it shape what you build next. Big thanks to EarthMind for sponsoring today's episode. Formerly known as Backyard Abundance, EarthMind is a nonprofit on a mission to help people cultivate well-being and connection through nature-based experiences. Their work is rooted in the belief that small, intentional actions like planting a garden, tending a patch of land, or gathering in a natural space can ripple out and renew how we care for ourselves, each other, and the earth. You can learn more about EarthMind's mission, programs, and resources by heading to the show notes. I'll link to the plan for our farm there as well, so you can see that. If this conversation made you feel something, if it reminded you that healing, growing, and reclaiming our way of living doesn't have to be flashy or fast, would you share it? Send it to a friend, a neighbor, or someone who's tending something sacred of their own. These small stories, they make a big impact. Before I go, I just want to say this. You know, in the day-to-day, it can feel like nothing's getting done. Like you're just not making a dent. I feel that way all the time. Maybe it's because I care so deeply, or maybe it's because I just want to do so much. But moments like this, where we get to pause, reflect, laugh about crazy things that happened, name what we've learned, they really help me realize that we have done a lot. We poured life and love into this place. And it adds up. The 1% really does add up, even when it doesn't feel like it. I want to thank you for listening to another episode of Wildly Intentional. Until next time, my friend, stay rooted, be brave, and live wildly intentional.